Welcome to the Watchdog. This is Low Key here on Mint Press for another action-packed episode. We are joined today by the venerable Alan McLeod. We have been regularly publishing stories that many have tried to suppress. For that reason, Mint Press is very much reliant on the support you can give it. So I would encourage anyone watching this to support us, not just through this YouTube channel by liking, sharing, subscribing, and commenting on this video, but also by supporting us on Patreon so we can continue to fight the power in the way that we are on a daily basis. Now, today, my guest is somebody who has published story after story with important scoops that have upset people in powerful positions in our society. And the story he brings to us today concerns the very well-known, world-famous billionaire, Elon Musk. And it's quite an interesting scoop. We're joined today by Alan McLeod, investigative journalist from Mint Press. Alan, thank you for joining us today.
What's going on, man? Nice to be back with you.
So to start with, you have this story about Elon Musk and his Starlink in Iran. Now, just start by breaking down for the viewers, what exactly is Starlink?
Yeah, I mean, Starlink is an internet service which allows anyone with a terminal to directly connect to one of many thousands of satellites that are orbiting the Earth. This is a very good system for people who live in rural areas or for people who want to get around government censorship, because ultimately you're communicating directly with the satellite. And that's really the reason why Elon Musk is pushing these into Iran specifically, so that activists can get around that country's internet sanctions program and cause more sort of anti-government protests, demonstrations, and just general feeling within the country.
So, Alan, if you can break down for us the trajectory of Elon Musk to superstardom, how did it happen? And what has been his relationship with the national security state in the US?
Yeah, sure. I guess his relationship with the US national security state goes back many years, in fact, two decades now. He's one of the things he's most known about is his company SpaceX, which is basically a rocket transportation service. But a lot of people don't know just how closely intertwined with the US government and the US military SpaceX is. So even before the company officially launched in March 2002, Musk already had a very, very close relationship with the CIA, and in particular, an individual at the CIA, the head of its venture capitalist firm, InQtel. His name is Mike Griffin. I should just say a lot of people are probably surprised to hear the CIA actually has a venture capitalist arm. The point of InQtel is to find businesses and individuals around the world who are at the cutting edge of technology or business and try to bring them into the fold so that they can supply the CIA and other three-letter organizations in Washington with the cutting edge of tech to keep them ahead of the Russians, the Chinese, and whatever enemy the CIA has. So in early 2002, Mike Griffin was such a believer in Elon Musk that he called him the next Henry Ford of the rocket industry and was banging his fist on the table saying, we need to get this guy in. And so strong was his belief in Musk that he actually personally accompanied Musk to Russia in order to help Musk buy intercontinental ballistic missiles for SpaceX. Now, in the cold light of 2023, that sort of fact seems absolutely ridiculous and impossible that that could have happened, but it's very well documented, even in corporate media at the time. And yeah, so SpaceX was this fledgling company, which Griffin was basically the midwife of, helped Musk push it through many years of slow and very painful growth. In fact, by 2006, SpaceX was hemorrhaging money, and it looked like it was going to go under when, out of the blue, it received a $400 million contract from NASA. And that was because Mike Griffin had actually been promoted to become the head of NASA. And he went over there and continued to really believe in Musk and said, we need to give this upstart company a big grant so that they can, you know, see what happens with them. Unfortunately, you know, by that time, SpaceX was still years away from actually making a successful launch. And again, the, you know, the rocket industry is something you just lose money on it constantly if you're not careful. And yeah, by 2008, Musk was thinking that both Tesla and SpaceX were going to have to go under. And he was personally putting his PayPal fortune into the company to try to keep it from flooding and sinking forever. For him, he was again saved by NASA, this time with a $1.6 billion check from them to provide them with certain rocket services. And this continues to this day because, of course, when you hear about SpaceX blasting payloads and satellites up into space, there are very few buyers for this sort of technology. It tends to be either the US government or the US military. And so time after time, SpaceX's clients include the CIA, the National Security Agency, the National Reconnaissance Office, or NASA. These are the sorts of companies that are actually putting up these thousands of satellites into the world. And what they're actually doing there, I mean, they tout the civilian benefits like really accurate GPS and everything. But really, this is a military and a security operation here. And in fact, the global surveillance program, which people like Edward Snowden have tried to warn us about, this is really what is helping this actually spread worldwide. And so ultimately, I would say that Musk is a key cog in the national security system and the global surveillance operation that we've seen over the last 15 or 20 years. And just to add to that, I mean, SpaceX just recently announced a new project, which is like a brand that is specifically designed towards going after the US military industrial complex as their client. It's called Starshield. And it's specifically going after there, trying to find ways of developing communications and technology products for the US military. And so, yeah, ultimately, Musk is one of the biggest Pentagon contractors out there. And yet he still manages to cultivate this idea of him as being some sort of renegade outsider, which, frankly, he really is not.
Interestingly, we know that SpaceX, just in the last couple of weeks, launched a reconnaissance satellite for Israel, the Eros C3, into low Earth orbit. Now, the Eros satellites are operated directly by ImageSat International, which is a firm linked to Israeli intelligence and regularly releases images of sites that Israel has bombed in Syria and Iran. So clearly working closely with the Israeli government. How can we explain then, Alan, you know, just off the top of your head, how Elon Musk's Twitter files rub up against this established relationship that he has had that has helped him massively on this trajectory to superstardom? What's happening here with the Twitter files then, in your estimation?
Sure. I mean, Elon is, I mean, at the same time as he is an insider, he's certainly somebody who refuses to close his mouth on certain aspects. And in the past 6 months or so, he's made it clear, very clear, in fact, that he really favors one side of the elite's political spectrum, the Republican Party, and not the other side, the Democratic Party. And I think the Twitter files for him was really a way of showing, trying to almost curry favor with that Republican side. I mean, his whole idea was that we have to bring back these right-wingers who've been purged from the site and, you know, restore quote-unquote free speech, even at the same time as if you talk to anybody from the global south, from Ethiopia to, I mean, Palestine is a great example of this. You know, people just espousing, you know, majority opinions on certain topics just get completely canned all the time, especially when it comes to Israel-Palestine. And so ultimately, I think Musk thought of the Twitter files as a way of inviting sympathetic journalists in to do hit pieces against his political opponents. However, as he's opened this door, I don't think he controlled it very well, because especially somebody like Li Fang at The Intercept has found some very interesting work, which actually relates to sorts of things I've been writing about in the last couple of years about the FBI and Twitter, showing how the previous Twitter administration was actually deeply in the pockets of the national security state, working closely with the FBI, carrying out their orders, doing what they were told, etc., going well beyond anything that they would have to legally be remitted to do. And so, yeah, ultimately, I think the cat is out of the bag, and people are not just looking at big social media companies anymore as, you know, things that, you know, organizations that might be biased, but they're starting to understand that they're actually a tool of the US government. And I think that's a very crucial distinction in terms of how we criticize Twitter, Facebook, et al.
And actually, interestingly, the Twitter files served as a bit of a catalyst for people to rediscover your work and even amplify it. In the case of, bizarrely, the Daily Mail, picking up on your fantastic story revealing many different people from several different US security agencies who had then gone on to work for Twitter, Google, Facebook, TikTok. And it's really interesting that the Daily Mail actually not only credited you and Mint Press in their article that they wrote, they actually chased up the leads of some of those people that you had identified. Now, I'm in no doubt that that was off the back of the Elon Musk story. What's your response to that? How did it feel to see a story that you've worked very hard on, sort of being rediscovered and then actually built upon by one of this country's, if not the, it's one of them, most right-wing newspapers in British history?
Yeah, I mean, I guess if you work in alternative media, you have to get used to corporate media stealing your scoops, because it just happens over and over again. I think this is a really important subject. What we see and what we don't see online directly affects national discussions, the debates that we have, and even what we think about. The sort of power companies like Facebook or Google or Twitter have to shape the national and international discourse is really difficult to underestimate and undersell. So I'm glad that certain bigger outlets are starting to cover this. I do wish it wasn't just the Daily Mail. As you said, they've got quite a disreputable reputation, to put it mildly, in the UK and worldwide. Hopefully, this is the first of many big outlets who will actually cover the story. And I'm hoping also that it doesn't get dropped down a sort of partisan lens, whereby the right wing and the Republican Party and its acolytes start to talk about themselves as being the ones who are constantly being harassed or censored. And that kind of falls into the sort of trope that right wingers only are being censored, because anybody who's an anti-war activist or a radical or anything like that knows fine well that these big social media companies, the biggest capitalist behemoths, some of them in world history, do not like people challenging the system or questioning the status quo, and will, and you know, if you do that, you will be actively suppressed, or at very least not given the same sort of platform as people who promote the status quo or want to drag it back to another era.
Absolutely. And you know, leading on from that, we've established Elon Musk and the Starlink project. Now, how does that relate to what exactly is happening in Iran now? What's the connection between Starlink, Elon Musk, and Iran?
Yeah, sure. So Elon's been kind of on a bit of a tweet spree about Iran recently on a post lionizing the brave women of Iran for taking off their veils and showing the government what they think of the mandate. Elon actually replied that there were now 100 Starlinks active in Iran. So clearly he's saying that these little satellite dishes, which you can put on your house or your car or something, and then directly communicate with the outside world, are part of a strategy to try to support anti-government movements in Iran. And this is really underscored by the fact that in September, Secretary of State Antony Blinken made a speech and just general comments about how, in the light of the protests that were engulfing Iran, the United States was tightening sanctions in some places, but also lifting sanctions on communications to make sure that big technology companies like WhatsApp, Instagram, Facebook, etc., all worked really well in Iran so that the Iranian people could hear the message that the US government wanted them to hear. And underneath that, Elon Musk just simply, not even cryptically, actually, just simply stated, activating Starlink, end quote. So it's clear that Musk seems to want to work with the US government in order to try to smuggle these Starlinks into the country to help activists. Now, whatever you think about that, maybe that's a good idea, maybe it isn't, it actually mirrors very closely what happened earlier this year, whereby Musk actually got worldwide headlines because of his quote-unquote donation of many thousands of Starlinks to quote-unquote the people of Ukraine. And yeah, he had international plaudits, the person who was, you know, saving Ukraine and helping free speech, etc. But it later transpired that this was less of a donation and more of a sale. And it was a sale not only facilitated by, but paid for by the US government, and specifically by USAID, which has a long history of being involved in foreign operations and regime change operations. And it also turned out that the prime beneficiaries and recipients of these Starlinks were less the Ukrainian people and more the Ukrainian military, including the super infamous Azov battalion. And the Ukrainian military took this high-tech stuff to heart and immediately began using it for military operations, unsurprisingly. In fact, it's now well established that Starlink is really keeping the Ukrainian military afloat. We have loads of quotes from senior generals or people in the government in Kiev talking about how their military actually runs on Starlink now, because all of this high-tech weaponry that we're sending Ukraine, you know, it all needs to be run via some sort of smart connection. And now it seems that a lot of Ukrainian commanders can't even fire their missiles or shoot their guns without using Starlink and going through that, because it needs this sort of high-tech weaponry to use their infrared systems or their thermal imaging cameras or any sort of like GPS or satellite-based communications or weapons really need to be, you know, they need some sort of internet connection to use. So yeah, ultimately Musk is like, maybe slightly over-egging the point to say that it's keeping the Ukrainian military in the field, but certainly Starlink is providing an exceptionally important service. And it seems that Musk has ideas about helping these Iranian activists challenge the government in a similar situation in Tehran.
So in a way, it's what some would call a narcissism of minor difference, in that you have Elon Musk going off the script slightly when it comes to Ukraine and about how peace can be reached. And of course, that at one point caused some friction between Elon Musk and a representative of the Ukrainian government. Then at the same time, you have him pointing to some of the ways in which the FBI have worked with Twitter to quell ideas which the national security state were not at ease with. But then simultaneous to that, really in a way that counts far more, he is a key collaborator in building the surveillance infrastructure in a massive way which buttresses all of this. I guess my question to you then, Alan, is just so if we can sort of contextualize the way that regime change across the decades has played out in Iran. What is that relationship between the US and Iran, even prior to the revolution of 1979?
Yeah, I mean, just a quick comment on what you said there. It does kind of feel like Musk is kind of repeating quite a boilerplate Republican strategy right now, where they have their beefs with the FBI. They, you know, people like Marjorie Taylor Greene are talking about defunding the FBI and sort of posing as a sort of dissident, anti-war, etc. But when it really comes down to it, their differences with the FBI tend to be, or the national security state in general, tend to be, you know, just about where that should be focused. And whether you're Democrat or Republican, for many decades, those two parties have agreed that the ire of Washington should really be focused on Iran, among other countries. In 1953, the democratically elected leader of Iran, Mohammad Mossadegh, who was not a communist, even if he was, that would still be completely against international law. He was much more of a sort of liberal, secular reformer. He was overthrown by the CIA. I think it was actually President Roosevelt's cousin, Kermit, who was one of the people that was most involved in this. They sent Kermit there to gin up agitators, to plant fake stories in the press, to build a protest movement and to pay off certain actors in order to get what they wanted. And what they wanted was Mossadegh out of power, because ultimately Mossadegh believed that the Iranian oil should be used to fund schools and hospitals that would help the Iranian people, instead of going into the bank accounts of big oil companies like the Anglo Oil Corporation, now known as BP, and the Seven Sisters, more generally, the big Western oil companies that ultimately control that industry. And so from the 1950s to the 1970s, Iran was controlled by a US-backed Shah who really ruled with an iron fist and alienated and repressed virtually every sector of society, to the point where in the late 70s, opposition to him really grew to the point where it really exploded in 1979 and the Iranian Revolution occurred, which was really actually... There was a lot of factors in there, but it ended up being led by the religious establishment in Iran. And so ultimately, the Shah was kicked out and the Ayatollah and the government was established there. And since 1979, the US has never forgiven Iran for overthrowing its satrap there. And so since then, we've seen sanctions, we've seen proxy wars against Iran. I'm thinking about the Iran-Iraq war, which devastated both of those countries in the 1980s. As I said, all sorts of economic warfare, political mudslinging, etc. Even today, the sanctions against Iran are crippling the economy, making sure that the Iranian rial doesn't keep its value, which means that people are losing their savings. Makes it very difficult for Iran to import and indeed export goods, including oil. And ultimately, that means that the country is crippled and hamstrung. And the point of this, US government officials are relatively open about, is to produce enough discontent in the country that they will overthrow their government. And hopefully, in Washington's eyes, it will be replaced by a new force which has liaised with Washington, or at least will be much more conducive to what the West needs, which is ultimately taking the wealth of that country and getting into the bank accounts of big US and European countries. And so that that foreign policy goal has been maintained for many decades, regardless of it's a guy with a red tie or a guy with a blue tie in the Oval Office. And so, yeah, it continues to this day.
Absolutely. I was about to make the same point, that this is actually essentially a bipartisan orthodoxy. You know, you look at the time when the revolution happened, the US actually had no permanent ground troops or on the ground in the region. And that is why many in the US national security establishment blame the fact that actually their nearest base at the time was Diego Garcia, which is 2,000 miles away in the middle of the Indian Ocean, with their slow response to the hostages in the U.S. embassy. Of course, when the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait happened, they were able to occupy bases throughout the region. You had also the Nixon doctrine, which was to build up, this was prior to, of course, the revolution, which was about building up Iran under the Shah and Israel as pillars of U.S. interests against Arab nationalism, but without U.S. bases, without the need for U.S. bases. Then obviously following that with the revolution, you had what was the Carter Doctrine, which basically developed something called the Zagros Mountain Strategy, which was a way in which the U.S. put together this plan of being able to invade Iran by seizing important mountain passes. You also have, once Ronald Reagan was elected in 1981, this aim to achieve what they called strategic consensus with the rest of the region. And actually in 1987, you had the USS Stark incident, where the Iraqi army actually fired on a U.S. naval ship during the Iran-Iraq war, mistaking it for an Iranian tanker, and 37 U.S. personnel died. And originally, the U.S. tried to blame Iran for that. You then had, following that in 1988, something called Operation Praying Mantis. And what was found is that this sabotaging of Iranian oil platforms, not just in Operation Praying Mantis, but also Operation Nimble Archer, was found by the International Court of Justice in 2003 that the actions of the United States in these two operations cannot be justified as measures necessary to protect the essential security interests of the USA. And then, you know, since then, the US has been able to establish its bases in places like Oman, Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, and others. And then you see, on top of this mission creep, really, of war against Iran across all of these decades, you've seen a sanctions regime, which specifically after the year that Trump reintroduced them, you saw prices rise in Iran by 31% immediately, and then the next year rise by 37%. And then you get unemployment hitting over 15% off the back of this rise in the effects of the sanctions. And then there being, you know, a place, Iran has one of the fastest growth rates for cancer in the world. There's literally over 100,000 new cases of cancer every single year. And because of the U.S. sanctions, and this is according to the International Journal of Health Policy and Management, and this is from the website of the National Institutes of Health, you see them directly blaming the increased deaths from cancer in Iran on the U.S. sanctions, which make it very, very difficult for people in Iran to obtain the kind of medicine that they need. So it's really a constant war that has been, a permanent state of war that has been exacted upon this country. And really, Alan, it kind of leads us into the next question, which is one of your other brilliant investigations, which also went viral and has been read by thousands of people, at least as we know so far, is the story of Call of Duty. Now, a recent Call of Duty edition, Call of Duty being the popular video game which many children play from a young age, and it kind of initiates them into a lot of the understandings of war, unfortunately, and can act as a bit of a gateway for people to later on have activity in the US military. Now, in what way has the latest edition of Call of Duty sort of appeared to have some connection to the war against Iran, would you say?
Well, the most obvious example of that is the opening level of the latest Call of Duty game, whereby it recreates the assassination of the Iranian general and statesman Qasem Soleimani. Now, in 2020, the Trump administration assassinated Soleimani while he was in Baghdad for peace talks with Saudi Arabia and other Gulf nations. This was an enormous crime. It can't be a war crime if you're not at war, but it's certainly a huge international crime. But in fact, in this edition of Call of Duty, it's actually you are the hero for taking out Soleimani. And the justification is that he is, you know, some sort of terrorist and that he's controlled by the Russians, which is laughable. They did change the general's name, but it's absolutely clear when you look at the picture of Soleimani and the picture of the guy in the video game that this is absolutely Qasem Soleimani. So people all around the world are encouraged, in fact, demanded to recreate this massive international incident for points, basically, and you can't even progress if you don't kill him. So this is just one more example of how Call of Duty is really very, very close to the US government and the US national security state. And the article you are referencing, I think it's called Call of Duty is a Government PSYOP. Something like These Documents Prove It is the subheadline. Yeah, I just went through some freely available documents that were obtained under the Freedom of Information Act by the journalist Tom Secker and went through just how closely Call of Duty, the people involved in making Call of Duty, the head honchos, are actually liaising very, very closely with the US military. So one example of that is Coco Franchini, who was a developer for Call of Duty, who was taken down to the US Air Force's HQ in Florida and given a demonstration about how all these weapons work. And it was basically, you know, a total PR exercise for the military. And the emails that the Air Force are sending back and forth to each other make this absolutely clear. They are giddy that, quote, heavy hitters, unquote, from Hollywood, like Coco Franchini, are coming down there to get them to know them better. They talk about it as an attempt to, quote, showcase, unquote, their hardware and make the entertainment industry, and again, this is another direct quote, more credible advocates, unquote, for the US war machine. And so ultimately, yes, the military liaises very, very closely with Call of Duty and other big games manufacturers. I think some people are more aware that this goes on in Hollywood, but it also goes on in the video games industry, which is much bigger in a lot of ways than Hollywood, and perhaps more important from a propaganda aspect, because, you know, Call of Duty rakes in billions of dollars per release. And not only that, it targets some of the most impressionable people in the world, which are young adolescent boys and young men as well. And these people play that. I mean, I'm not, you know, I was guilty of this as a kid as well, you know, playing these games and even into my early adulthood, playing these games with extremely controversial content, such as basically recreating war crimes in Iraq, for example. And people play these for weeks and months on end and are just fed ideology constantly. And it becomes even more blatant when you actually look at the parent company of Call of Duty, which is Activision Blizzard. If you actually look at the sort of people who work in the higher echelons of these companies, it becomes absolutely clear what's up. So, for instance, until September, Francis Townsend was Activision Blizzard's chief science officer and the executive vice president for corporate affairs. Now, Townsend is one of the key figures in the war on terror. She was head of intelligence for the Coast Guard, and then she was assistant to the Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice. She was her counterterrorism deputy. That's the Bush administration's counterterrorism czar. What else did she do? She was appointed by President Bush to be on his intelligence advisory board. She became the White House's most senior advisor on terrorism and homeland security. And in fact, she helped popularize the term enhanced interrogation techniques, which was this classic 2000s term for the use of torture to obtain information from people taken from places like Afghanistan and Iraq and thrown into places like Abu Ghraib or Guantanamo Bay. In fact, when she visited Guantanamo Bay, the head of the facility actually testified that she put him under a lot of pressure to ramp up the torture that was going on there to try to exert even more information from these people, almost none of whom have even been charged. So, you know, this is what she's doing. She, you know, fast forward to the Trump administration, and Donald Trump reportedly even was thinking about offering her the post of the head of the FBI. But in the end, she didn't take that job. And then instead, she took this complete 90-degree turn into becoming the head of a video games company, which seems absolutely crazy on its face of it. But when you look at the sort of content that Call of Duty is putting out, it becomes absolutely clear why the U.S. military and the U.S. national security state would want someone like that in there. I'll give you one more example of another guy. Brian Bulatau was third in command. He was the chief operating officer of the CIA, and he left that job to become one of the heads of Activision Blizzard. He became chief administration officer for Activision Blizzard just a couple of years ago. He, by all accounts, served as Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State's quote-unquote attack dog. Former colleagues talking about how he was this extremely angry, bullying person who would really browbeat his employees. And so he probably didn't do much for Activision Blizzard's reputation for having a really toxic culture. But again, we see this phenomenon time and time again of people stepping out of national security and going immediately into the entertainment industry or into the media. So whether it's, you know, the NATO to TikTok pipeline, or whether it's going from the CIA to Google or Facebook, or whether it's like Bulatau going from the CIA and getting a job, not even just a job, getting a controlling role, a chief executive officer kind of position in big media companies like Activision Blizzard. We're seeing how the military really wants to sink its claws into all aspects of our life, whether it's the media or whether it's more soft news and entertainment like video games.
Interestingly, and it's not a purposeful thing, a lot of our work seems to be grappling with that relationship between quote-unquote popular culture and the interests of the military-industrial complex and the national security state. So as you've pointed to, you've got social media companies, you've got films. An interesting thing that crossed my mind when we were thinking about Guantanamo Bay and the relationship between all of this stuff is music of Eminem and Barney the Dinosaur was actually used to torture people within Guantanamo Bay. So it's quite interesting, this crossover that's happening between the military and the culture, and really culture becoming a sort of plaything slash handmaiden of the military. One interesting thing that I also wanted to bring up earlier was a video in which Rudy Giuliani, who is a darling of much of the Iranian opposition in exile, talking about how sanctions have affected people in Iran. And he's actually spelling out explicitly what we stated earlier, that sanctions are aimed to create the conditions for revolt and revolution. He says it. Those are the words of Rudy Giuliani, not me. And in this clip that we're about to play, he actually almost takes pleasure in the fact that people are selling their own organs. I mean, it's a really horrifying clip. So we're just going to play that now.
They're going to be overthrown. The people of Iran obviously have now had enough. The sanctions are working. The currency is going to nothing. They're where Russia was. They're where Poland was. We see signs of young men and women saying, give me some food. We saw a sign of a man trying to sell his internal organs for $500 American, probably a fortune in Iran today. This is truly pitiful. These are the kinds of conditions that lead to successful revolution and, God willing, nonviolent revolution.
Now, another thing that has come to light about the assassination of Qasem Soleimani is the Iraqi Supreme Court has recently announced that they've put out an arrest warrant for Donald Trump and others for this assassination. Now, something that Trump said after leaving office is definitely of interest. He said to Israeli journalist Barak Ravid that he was actually very disappointed in Israel over the assassination. And actually, it seemed he was personally angry at Benjamin Netanyahu for some reason in relation to the assassination. And he even said, in a very sort of mysterious twist, he said, people will be hearing about that at the right time. Now, when we look at the possible involvement of Israel, we do also have a Yahoo piece which states that Israeli intelligence assisted in the assassination by sharing phone numbers with the US. But also, we know that Qasem Soleimani is credited by not only forces like Hamas and the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, but also groups like PFLP and Fatah, with actually arming them at several different points. Ziad Nakhala from Jihad al-Islami even states in an interview that there was nothing that was coming in to Gaza to support the resistance that was not having some involvement from Qasem Soleimani. We saw even a group of Palestinians in Gaza drawing his face into the beach in a really interesting and original display of solidarity. It's important to remember that actually the drones that eventually fired the shots on Qasem Soleimani and others that were in the convoy, those drones were being coordinated from the US Ramstein military base in Germany. And there's many that point to Germany as therefore having a complicit role in what happened. It's also believed that there were spies at the airport in Damascus who passed on information to the US intelligence services about the time, the exact time that his plane took off and headed to Baghdad. The Israeli intelligence services were actually stationed alongside US Joint Special Operations Command liaisons in Tel Aviv and were monitoring the telephones that he possessed. And so he switched his phone three times in the 6 hours leading up to the flight. And what you had was a situation where sniper teams were actually positioned in a triangle in the around what they called the kill zone. So this is how planned out this operation was. The sniper teams actually were disguised as workers and were able to gain access to these locations around what they called the kill zone in preparation for his arrival to the airport. And actually, the snipers had a camera attached to their weapon, which gave a live stream directly back to the U.S. embassy in Baghdad. That's one of the biggest U.S. embassies in the world, where you had the Delta Ground Force commander actually observing and monitoring the mission. And then above that, you had the three US drones that were controlled from the base in Germany overhead and getting ready for the arrival. You also had another group, the KRG counterterrorism group. So it's linked to the Kurdish regional government in Iraq. That were also involved on the ground as the sort of ground agents of the assassination. That entailed them having people disguised as ground crew who actually guided the plane to the ground. And then you had agents who were supposed to be baggage handlers who actually identified Soleimani as he stepped off the plane. You even had involvement of the ISA intelligence support activity, which the US calls Task Force Orange, that were also involved on the ground getting exact coordinates for this assassination. So we see this interesting net that was kind of placed around this general who in many ways and in many places in the world is revered for different reasons. Some of them for helping to get rid of Daesh in Iraq and Syria. And undoubtedly, what the US did was commit a heinous crime. What we're seeing, though, is the ability of the US in Iraq and in other places to do similar type of operations becoming more and more tenuous and precarious with the decline of US power. It's likely we will see less operations of this sort. So the killing of Qasem Soleimani was one aspect, actually, of a US war against humanity over these past decades, which has seen millions of people displaced. And it hasn't just been confined to the Middle East. Many have perceived the war on terror and this period as being concentrated with intensity on the Middle East. But Alan, you know, if you could just break down for us, what has been the human cost in terms of displacement from all these wars? But where else has US militarism touched in these past years?
Sure. Well, the cost of war project at Brown University has for years tried to actually put a number on some of these some of the sort of devastation that's going on, put a number on the human toll. And what they've found is they estimate that up to 6 million people have died in the post 9/11 wars, primarily in Western Asia, but also abroad. Not only that, the US wars have also created around 38 million refugees since 9/11. The countries most affected have been the ones you might already suspect, which is Iraq with over 9 million people, Syria over 7 million people displaced, Afghanistan nearly 6 million people, Yemen, that's nearly 5 million people, and Somalia in the Horn of Africa, which has over 4 million people displaced, due in no small part because of these wars against terrorism, so-called, that the United States has prosecuted. So this is an enormous human toll that's really been levied across the world. But the fact of the matter is that we just simply don't see very much about this in the news. It's not in people's radars. When we talk about the costs of the Iraq war, I think most people in the West think of that soldier they saw with one leg rather than an entire village destroyed or an entire area of a country that has lost its sewage system and people are drinking in infected water or poisoned water, or people who've had their lives destroyed because they've had to flee their country. And for years, this sort of refugee problem was going on, but it simply wasn't being addressed precisely because it wasn't directly affecting white countries in North America or Western Europe. And so it's only really in the last few years that Europeans have started talking about a refugee problem. Unfortunately, the link between NATO adventurism and, let's be clear here, international war crimes, and the fact that all of these people in their millions are trying to flee their country has never been made. Ultimately, the countries that refugees are coming from are countries that the United States and the UK and others have been building relentlessly for years. It's Iraq, it's Syria, it's Afghanistan. But it's not places like Lebanon or Oman, let's say, which haven't really been bombed. And that's really the key here. When you destroy somebody's entire country with a huge sledgehammer, they want to leave, but they don't really feel committed to leaving if you're not destroying it. So one way of stopping this refugee crisis, so-called, would just be to stop destroying these people's countries and, you know, let them live normal lives. This is also going on across Africa as well, people fleeing sub-Saharan Africa and trying to escape to Europe. And one of the reasons is that the United States and France and other countries are deeply involved militarily on that continent. In fact, between 2013 and 2017, one of the heads of AFRICOM, the United States' military operation in Africa, Brigadier General Don Bolduc, he said that the United States had seen combat operations in 13 separate African countries, and they range from Burkina Faso to Tunisia. So really across the entire continent, the US has dozens of military bases in Africa. And many people who are closely following this say that the United States is effectively at war with Africa using sophisticated technology like drones to really surveil the continent and even, you know, threaten strikes, which can happen pretty much at any point. The US has huge bases for drones in the west of Africa, which really can be used to launch strikes against hundreds of millions of people. So more generally, people nowadays in Western Asia and in Africa often fear the thought of having clear skies, because that means a drone strike could be happening. They pray for cloudy days. And that is really one of the things that is the most sad and depressing about this two-decade-long war that has been prosecuted, is that it's really taken away hope for hundreds of millions of people.
In the 2 decades of, on average, U.S. Forces dropping 46 bombs per day, and you saw one of the places that bore the worst of the war on terror was, of course, Fallujah in Iraq. And to this day, you actually see babies being born with really significant defects and high rates of cancer. And there is a Twitter account which does its best to track those cases and on a daily basis publish stories about these poor children being born with defects. And many believe that those have been caused, including Noam Chomsky, and many put it as having a cancer rate much higher even than Hiroshima. What you see is the use of depleted uranium and white phosphorus in Fallujah. And it's also important to remember how the problems in Fallujah began was when the US came in and occupied a school. And it was the occupation of a primary school, which then led to a demonstration against the US occupation, which then the US fired upon and killed people. And so then the resistance developed. And things escalated to the point where the US used white phosphorus and depleted uranium on the area. And that's why it's believed today you have people being born in this situation. And the United States, this is really the arrogance and the avarice of empire, in which you see the US actually now naming the Navy, naming one of its ships after Fallujah. And on this topic of computer games, you see a video game being made and released very soon called 6 Days in Fallujah, which is based on one of the cursed US campaigns in Fallujah. So here at Mint Press, we will continue to do what we can to shine a light on the infrastructure of this violence, which victimizes millions of people across the planet. And we do hope that you can support us in any way you can going forward. Thank you very much for joining us, Alan.
Good to be with you as always.